All right. Hello, everyone. Happy Monday evening. And I am going to be sharing from Nisar Gadatta's book, I Am That. These are actually transcribed and translated conversations. The man who transcribed and translated these conversations is named Maurice Friedman. Right now, on Wednesdays, I teach The Guiding Light, but right now I'm teaching from a book with Ramana Maharshi's teachings called The Spiritual Teachings of Ramana Maharshi that is also transcribed and translated conversations, and Maurice Friedman did that too. So Maurice Friedman, who didn't put his name on either of these books that I'm currently teaching from, brought us both of those books. So he's passed on by now, but Maurice Friedman, I just want to say thank you. And I'm going to put a link in the room. This is a link to the PDF. There's a PDF version of I Am That. So anybody who likes to read along, you can just click on that link and open up the PDF and read along. I am going to jump right in. If you open up the PDF, you'll notice there's like an introduction and all of this stuff. You can just scroll right past all of that and go to conversation number one, which is called The Scam. And that's where I'm going to begin. And again, I'm going to just jump right in because I only have half an hour, and I don't mean that as a hint that I hope we find an hour for me, because the truth is I only want half an hour. But it does mean that I'll be jumping right in every week and using this half hour well. So starting with number one, conversation number one, the sense of I am. The questioner asks, it is a matter of, oh, I can wait. I can take my earplugs out. I'm not listening anymore. I have my earbuds in because I was listening, but I don't need them to hear myself. Okay, questioner. It is a matter of daily experience that on waking up, the world suddenly appears. Where does it come from? And Nisargadatta Maharaj says, before anything can come into being, there must be somebody to whom it comes. Appearance, disappearance presupposes a change, some changeless background. And I'm going to post the link again because I noticed a couple other people have popped into the room. And if you want to read along, you can do it at this link. I want to read that sentence again, too, because, again, this is a very important sentence. It's wonderful that it's right up here at the front of the book. The question was, upon waking up every morning, there's a world. Where does that world come from? And the answer that Nisargadatta gives is, before anything can come into being, again, before anything can come into being, there must be somebody to whom it comes. All appearance and disappearance presupposes a change against some changeless background. And even though the term somebody is used, there must be somebody to whom it comes, what he really means is someone or a subject, a witness, a watcher. What he's pointing out, which is, I think, probably fairly obvious to some of us now because of our own inquiry, our own paying attention, but not obvious to everyone. What he's pointing out is that in order for anything to appear, you have to be first. You have to exist first. If you aren't, then nothing is. I've noticed that when I make my posts on the website, our new website grades our posts. grades our English, tells us our readability. And I often get red readability scores, which are really poor. And I'm sure that's because of sentences like the one I just said. If you aren't, nothing is. Now, that gives me a red readability score when I write that down in a post. But it's true. You are primary. You are first. You are literally the Alpha and the Omega. Without you, nothing else could appear. And this is a very important thing to contemplate. And I remember the very first time I heard such a teaching, I really thought it was referring to the somebody, the body. And I thought, well, that's not true, because even if I die today, everything's still going to exist. First of all, if there was such a thing as death, if I died today, nothing could exist for me, right? There would be no me. Nothing could exist for me. That is very, very certain. But even as we go deeper into the contemplation of awareness, what we find is that, you know, like your awareness, my awareness is the same awareness. So even if this body, this Regina body, dies and ceases to exist, awareness is still present. Right? Awareness is still present. And if you could snuff out all awareness, then nothing could appear. I really think, you know, I'm not much of a philosophy student, but I really think it's what some philosopher, some of you guys might know the name of the philosopher, but I really think it's what some philosopher was contemplating when he said, if a tree falls in the forest and there's no one there to hear it, does it make a sound? Right? It's looking at the primary nature of the observer. And if you guys know anything about quantum physics, and again, almost nothing about quantum physics, but of course I've seen, you know, a couple of movies. The one we watched recently about Rabbit Hole, or What the Bleep, right? I've seen What the Bleep and, you know, a couple other movies about quantum physics. And what the quantum physicians are saying is without an observer, nothing exists. An observer is required for an appearance to appear. That's how primary we are. That's how important we are. The world could not appear to exist without us first, without awareness first. And so that contemplation of how primary we are, and that sounds a little arrogant using those words, but actually when you contemplate it, it's arrogance. It feels heart-centered, so it feels humble. Humble to contemplate our true nature. So that's how this book opens up, is just with that opportunity to contemplate that. But, you know, the questioner didn't pause. What's really funny, you know, I just paused. I just took Nisargadatta Maharaj's two sentences, and I paused, and I looked at it. And one thing that you'll notice when you read these books sometimes is the questioner never pauses. The questioner just dives right into the next question. And I remember once when I was watching a YouTube video with Eckhart Tolle, and there was a questioner sitting on a park bench with him and asking him some questions. And Eckhart Tolle would answer the question perfectly, but as soon as Eckhart Tolle quit speaking, the questioner would ask another question. And Eckhart Tolle pointed that out to him, that there was never a pause. There was never a to see if what Eckhart Tolle had just said was true. There was just another question. So I think that's something that we can all also contemplate, right? It's okay to ask a question. There's nothing wrong with asking a question. But do we ask the question and then take the answer, contemplate it? You know, look at the answer in our own experience. Is that true? Or do we just run on to the next question? So again, the question was, of course, you know, where does this world come from, the one that I see when I wake up every morning? And Maharaj pointed out, he didn't really answer it except to say, you have to be here first, right? There has to be somebody to whom it appears. There has to be a changeless background that change can occur on. And then the questioner says, before waking up, I was unconscious. And again, that may be the experience that many of us have too, right? When we're asleep, we're unconscious. And that 8 hours or 6 hours or whatever goes by like this, right? Because we're unconscious. Nisargadatta Maharaj says, in what sense? Having forgotten or not having experienced? Don't you experience even when unconscious? Can you exist without knowing? A lapse in memory, is it a proof of non-existence? And can you validly talk about your own non-existence as an actual experience? You cannot even say that your mind did not exist. Did you not wake up on being called? And on waking up, was it not the sense I am that came first? Some seed consciousness must exist even during sleep or swoon. On waking up, the experience runs. I am the body in the world. It may appear to arise in succession, but in fact it is all simultaneous. A single idea of having a body in a world. Can there be the sense of I am without being somebody or other? Lots and lots of questions there for contemplation. You know, we're very, very lucky this is written down. The questioner didn't have that advantage. These questions were all thrown at him. Boom, 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 boom. And unless he had a very quick contemplative mind, I'm sure that he missed most of it, and we'll find out in a moment. This is not the first time that I've really read this type of questioning. The first time I read this type of questioning about sleep actually came from Ramana Maharshi. He would use the same type of questioning whenever anybody would say, well, when I'm asleep, I'm unconscious. And he would begin to ask them questions. Are you sure? And the first time I read that, I was kind of like, yeah, I'm sure. Yeah, I'm sure I was unconscious. But then I read it again and contemplated it and read it again and contemplated it and read it again and looked. And I realized I'm not unconscious when I'm asleep. What's not there, which makes us think that we're unconscious when we're asleep, what's not there is subject-object consciousness, duality, in effect. Like right now, I can look at the board, you know, and I can see you. You know, I see Cynthia and Doreen and George and Laura and Jacqueline and Dove and Cheryl and Ken, hopefully I didn't leave anybody out. I can see you. I can see you. That's subject-object consciousness. And when I go to sleep, that isn't there. But I am not unconscious. How do I know I'm not unconscious? Because if my dog gets up and shakes, which is what she does when she wants to go outside. She'll get up and then she'll shake. She's waking herself. I wake up. If my alarm goes off, I wake up. Lately I've had pains in my back. And when the pains get severe enough, I wake up. If I was unconscious, think about what those words mean, unconscious. If I was unconscious, I would not be aware of the dog shaking, the alarm clock, or severe pain. Right? So I'm not unconscious. There is still an awareness. And in fact, another thing that I did when I was contemplating this type of teaching is I would watch Jamie, my dog. You know, she also appears unconscious. In fact, right now she's over there on her bed asleep. That's what she always does when I teach. This must be very, very boring for her because she looks at me, notices I'm teaching, and lays down and goes to sleep. And she appears unconscious. And in fact, I could get up and I could walk around this room and I can do anything I want. I can make any noise I want. I can be as loud as I want. And that dog is going to keep right on sleeping. She appears unconscious. But how do I know she's not unconscious? Because if there is a single sound in the environment that's out of place, she wakes up immediately. Somehow, even while asleep, she knows the difference between my noise, and I belong in the environment. She knows the difference between my noise, if Ron was here, Ron's noise, and an out-of-place noise. As a dog, she knows that. And she would wake up immediately to an out-of-place noise. So something, there's consciousness in her, and it's not only consciousness, it's discerning consciousness. Even while she's asleep. It's discerning dog consciousness. It knows the difference between the sounds that belong here and the sounds that don't. And the truth is, I then took that back to me and I looked at that and I thought, well, you know what? I have that same discerning consciousness. And do you know how I know that? Because when Ron is here, Ron's only here usually on Friday, Saturday, and Sunday nights. So Monday through Thursday, I typically sleep, well, I don't sleep alone. I sleep alone with Jamie. 4 nights a week, and then 3 nights a week I sleep with Ron and Jamie, right? Well, when Ron is not here, I'm the one that's responsible to let Jamie out if she has to go to the bathroom in the middle of the night. So as I mentioned, when she gets up and she shakes, I wake up. I'm aware of that. I wake up and I, you know, let her out. But when Ron is here, he takes her out. And guess what? When Ron is here, I don't hear Jamie get up and shake. When Ron is here, he'll tell me things like, Jamie got up 3 times last night. Well, she never me. She takes, you know, she feels spoiled of him. She only gets up 0 to 1 a night with me. But he'll say, she got up 3 times last night. I didn't get any sleep. Every time I'd lay down, she'd get up again. And I didn't hear any of that. I slept right through it. So you see that same discerning consciousness is there even while I'm asleep. Somehow, my awareness knows when I'm responsible for the dog and when I'm not. Think about this. This is not the thinking mind. When I'm responsible for the dog and when I'm not, and when I am responsible, it hears that subtle sound of her getting up and shaking. And when I'm not responsible, it doesn't hear that. It doesn't hear anything that goes on. And, you know, some of you have been parents. If you're parents, you know that you are aware when that baby makes the tiniest noise. Right? And again, I'm sure there are other noises that happen in your environment at night that have nothing to do with you, that you're not responsible for, they're not a problem, and you sleep right through them every night. So see, we have that same discerning, aware consciousness while we're sleeping as that dog does. And somehow intuitively we know this too, because intuitively when we wake up, there's not this thought, oh my God, I was dead for 8 hours, right? I ceased to exist. Somehow intuitively we know we exist even while we're asleep. And I've heard people say before, you know, yeah, but that's not true when you have surgery. And it is true, to a point. I'll talk about that in a moment. I've had surgery a couple times in the last few years, so I've had the advantage of being able to contemplate that experience as well. It's true, thank God, when I'm in surgery, I am not aware of things like, you know, like them. Well, one of the surgeries was they cut my wrist open and inserted a false wrist. I have a fake wrist here, and took out all the broken bones that I had. I bet that would have hurt like hell if I'd been conscious of it, right? But thank God I wasn't. And I don't quite understand why, you know, I understand what in the brain they're able to trigger. I'm sure, you know, a brain person could tell you. They're able to do something in the brain with those drugs that I'm not aware. At least not aware at that level. But I know for a fact there was still an awareness. And in fact, Michael Jackson is somewhat my proof. Because when I first woke up from surgery, this happened both times, there was something in me that was aware I had been in complete bliss. It wasn't a memory, you know, because you don't remember anything. There was just this knowing that I had been in complete bliss. And the reason I say Michael Jackson is my proof is because Michael Jackson also knew that when you are out like that, you're experiencing complete bliss. And this is why he requested to be put out over and over and over again, eventually until he died, even though there's no memory. So there's still some type of a timeless, non-subject object awareness. And if you haven't looked at this deeply, start looking. Look at your own experience. Don't believe me. Don't believe Nisargadatta Maharaj. Don't believe Ramana Maharshi. Start paying attention. You're going to become aware of the fact that there is an awareness that is beyond subject-object awareness. So even when subject-object awareness disappears, when the mind is completely asleep, there's still awareness present, a different kind of awareness, but it's there. Now, what I'm going to talk about next, I don't know yet from a personal experience. But I might read something to you in just a second. From what I understand from those who say they do know, when we wake up, awakening is waking up from the limited subject-object awareness into the awareness that is prior, into the awareness that does not come and go. And in fact, some of you guys have probably read this week. You know, we read chapter 1 from the Eternal Bliss book this week. And he talks about how the awareness that wakes up in the morning is the background of awareness. Do you remember reading this? And that's what we're paying attention to. And somewhere in here, let's see if I can find it quickly. He talks about how the background of awareness is the doorway to infinite awareness. And I can't find it quickly, but those are probably the exact words. The background of awareness is the doorway to infinite awareness. The infinite awareness is that awareness that does not come and go. That infinite awareness is the awareness that is always present. Present when we're asleep, right? And again, the reason we aren't aware of that awareness now is because we have turned away, because we have the habit of looking outward through the mind with subject-object awareness. We have the habit of looking outward through the mind of subject-object awareness. And because that is our habit, that is all we are aware of. We are not aware of the awareness that is prior to. And this is what our spiritual practice is all about, is waking up to the awareness that is prior to, the awareness that does not come and go. like subject-object awareness, definitely comes and goes. It's there when you are awake. It's even there when you are dreaming, but it is not there in deep sleep. Cheryl is asking, would you say that awareness is on the unconscious level? It's unconscious. That's kind of hard to. It is not something that we are aware of, is a better way to answer it. It is not something that we are aware of when we are habitually looking out. So yeah, you could say in that way that it's unconscious. It's repressed. It's not really repressed, but it's forgotten. It's ignored. This is why people say it's ignorance. And I only have 4 minutes left, so let me see if I can pull up my new friend Bentinho has sent me something, which I'm very, very, very slowly reading, a very long thing that he sent me to read. But let me read a little bit of that to you in my last few minutes here. He says, after several years of practicing resting as awareness, so awareness watching awareness, right? After several years of practicing resting as awareness, I penetrated beyond all that into the absolute. I directly realized that the absolute me is beyond all perception, beyond all creation, beyond everything, beyond even conscious awareness as we know it to be. There is nothing beyond this absolute. It is infinitely absolute, absolutely infinite, absolutely one, indescribable, unimaginable. It is final completion. This penetrative experience of being beyond all perception and all creation showed me that there was a realization or disappearance possible way beyond what most of us consider to be enlightenment. Penetrating into the absolute made awakened living seem like nothing at all in comparison. Just more mind, more illusion. So what he might be talking about here is true perception, or what the Course would call the real world. But if you've read the Course carefully, you know that it's true perception and the real world are still a dream. And that's what he's saying here, right? That penetrating into the absolute made awakened living, right, true perception, seem like nothing at all in comparison. Just more mind, more illusion. This was true liberation, beyond all levels and utterly indescribable. And the Course does make a difference, a differentiation between the real world and heaven, right? Heaven is beyond perception entirely. And this is what Bentinho seems to be talking about. He says, initially, I did not have a desire to merge deeper into it, nor did I have the capacity or maturity to. He said, I wanted to experience what this body-mind, you know, would, world teaching experience would do. But then he says, I penetrated beyond the bubble of being energy consciousness, and it allowed me to always have an intuitive transparency to this beyondness, occasionally popping entirely through the gateway of the black hole and being stunned by the indescribable perfection. This reminds me of that bliss I talked about. I knew that I had experienced when I woke up from surgery, right? Indescribable perfection and a transcendence that fills one with impeccable freedom and a sense of having graduated from creation, having attained the final completion. So it's an amazing opening to I Am That, you know, that really Nisargadatta Maharaj is pointing to that which is totally beyond our current experience as the infinite, as truth. And as that, which is completely possible for us to wake up to. And notice again that Bentinho is talking about it was resting as awareness that brought him to these breakthroughs, which he admits he has not sustained because he became interested again in looking out. And of course, he's a young man, right? Lots of fun things to experience. So that's where I'm going to stop. And next week I will begin again with the next question. And Cheryl and Kim, what I will do each week after I let go of the mic is I will contemplate what the name of the teaching should be, and I will give you that name. But tonight I'll create the first post as an example. All right? Thank you, everyone, for hanging out with me for this half an hour. Bye-bye.